I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 122 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, that's crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm or download us after broadcast using iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990. It's a U.S. phone number, so you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. Today, I'm with Paul Street, who is an independent researcher, journalist, historian, author, and speaker based in Iowa City and Chicago. He's the author of seven books, They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy, 2014, The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power, 2010, Crashing the Tea Party, Mass Media and the Campaign to Remake American Politics, 2011, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics, 2008, Racial Oppression in the Global Metropolis, A Living Black Chicago History, from 2007, Empire and Inequality in 2004, and a book on segregated schools in 2005. While at the Chicago Urban League from 2000 to 2005, he was responsible for studies on race, prison, and employment in Chicago, and the state of the large black community in that city. He's also written articles for several U.S. and international media outlets, been interviewed many times by a variety of media, and has taught at American history at several Chicago colleges and universities. His website is paulstreet.org, and today we're going to talk about the Electoral College and other election issues. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great, and it's a good time to talk about the Electoral College because we've experienced another U.S. election where the winner of the popular vote, Hillary Clinton, is not the winner of the Electoral College. Donald Trump won the Electoral College, but was about 2 million votes shy on the popular vote, I understand it, at present.
I saw something recently, the sixth time in American history. It's the second time in my lifetime, and I'm guessing in your lifetime. It was 2000-2001. The Electoral College is a openly, explicitly anti-democratic, authoritarian part of the Constitution that was put in for the explicit purpose of blocking popular self-rule in case, as far as the founders were concerned, you know, in case some excessively socialistic, populistic, rabble-rousing candidate were to get in and threaten property rights. The Founding Fathers and your listeners can all get a copy of the Federalist Papers, all the arguments that Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and John Jay made for the Constitution. They were all quite, democracy was sort of their ultimate nightmare.
Somebody told me recently, America's not a republic. America is a republic, not a democracy. I didn't think those two things were mutually exclusive, but
well, I separate them, and I see them as different sorts of things. The Constitution is a document crafted by a small R Republicans. I say that small R to identify their worldview, not their any political affiliation at the time. And small R Republicans thought that governments should be very much in the hands, as John Jay, one of the founders, said, the people who own the country ought to run it. There were property qualifications. Anyone who didn't hold property, including the majority of the white population, forget the disenfranchisement of females and slaves and Native Americans and so forth, anyone who didn't hold property was held to be highly suspect. They didn't have a stake. They didn't have a vested interest in the society. They shouldn't have a voice in its governance. And that's kind of what's the mentality of the property-owning gentry on both sides of the Atlantic, in England and the United States at the time of the nation's founding. And while we have these Republican, I think, sort of absurd, and we're kind of frozen into this structure of politics that was imposed by these sort of, I call them aristo Republicans, including leading slave owners, a vastly wealthy merchant capitalist like John Hancock in the Northeast. I really don't like to hear people say that we're a republic, not a democracy, because democracy is one person, one vote. And if you ask me historically, really since the 1830s and then on, the country has thought of itself and sold itself to itself and to people abroad, primarily, you know, as a one-person, one-vote type of society. And certainly that's been the rhetoric I grew up with. We are a democracy.
Well, it's not
and, you know, to say we're a republic is kind of bizarre, really.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, but what they mean is it's a federation of states. And one of the arguments for the Electoral College is it represents the states' rights better than popular vote.
Well, and of course, the way it actually plays out in our modern politics is that it gives this kind of grotesque over-representation to small states, which are predominantly rural states and which tend to be Republican states. So, yeah, I mean, you've got, you know, say you're a state with just one. There are a number of states in this country, oh, I don't know how many, with just one congressperson, right? But every state has two senators. That was set up in the Constitution. That's part of what you're talking about, too. So even with a tiny population, less than, let's say, the population in the Chicago metro area, considerably less when you think about it, and probably less than other metro areas, you've got three whole Electoral College votes for a state like that. You know, it's kind of strange.
Well,
I mean, it's not Democratic. It's something else, yeah.
Why three if there's only two senators?
I think your electoral total per state is the number of congresspersons you have plus the number of senators you have. So, for example, Iowa now used to have five House of Representatives members. They lost population. They're down to four. So my understanding is Iowa, where I'm talking to you from, has six electoral college votes. Yeah, four plus two.
Okay. It's not just the left that's said that the Electoral College is a problem. Newt Gingrich said, and I don't know the date of when he said this, but it wasn't this year, I'm sure. He said, we're a country of 314 million people, the most diverse nation on Earth. This is one of our greatest strengths. And it means our president must be the president of an enormously complex and varied country. Unfortunately, the current system for electing presidents does not reflect this tremendous diversity. The winner-take-all method of allotting electoral votes means candidates must focus their efforts on just a handful of closely divided states.
Right.
There's a couple of things.
When did Gingrich say this?
I can probably find out. I think it was one election ago.
So he's saying that when the Democrats are winning, but now he's going to be quite happy to go into the Trump administration.
Well, I do have a date.
Oh yeah,
it's
amazing. I do want to follow up on that. It is amazing the way it is structured now. We only really have a presidential election in a relative minority of states. I lived in Chicago for years, and it was almost as if it was already a done deal. It was going to be blue. And when I moved to Iowa, it is just a world of difference, in part because you have the caucuses. So you're swamped with the presidential candidates a year before the rest of the country. But then it continues because you're in play for those all or nothing votes. There's still, you know, and this is where the presidential election is, much more in Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, with the big electoral colleges. But it's absurd that our presidential elections are focused on battleground states just about completely.
So
Nick Gingrich is right.
Yeah. So in Texas, which is normally Republican, and California, which is normally Democrat, I presume the presidential candidates don't really care too much. There's no point.
There's not much point in spending too much energy in a California or a New York, or for that matter, in a Mississippi or Alabama, a deep state South, because it's frankly, it's just already a done deal. And I have lived the two experiences of living in a safe state and in a contested state, and it truly is night and day. It's just completely different. Now, you know, this problem that is the Electoral College, One of the problems in the Constitution is that fixing it and getting rid of it and moving to popular majority vote of the presidency, which is what every other advanced industrial, democracy. And by the way, we do call ourselves a democracy. That's what any democracy does. We're very distinct in that way. We're clinging to this document, this parchment that's set up by a bunch of rich guys with powdered wigs in the late 18th century. But getting rid of that technically would require a constitutional amendment. And the founders were very careful in Article 5 of the Constitution to make constitutional amendments incredibly difficult, probably prohibitively difficult right now, given the amount of big business Republican money that would make it very impossible. What is it? You have to get 2/3 of the states. So there's two different paths to it. And it's endless, and it's very complicated. But there are initiatives at the state level, and I think 11 states have already done this, to try and get rid of it without the burdensome, expensive process of an amendment, which is just for states to, at the level of the state legislature, I think they can do this, in fact, they can do this, to pledge that come the next presidential election, all their electors will honor whatever the popular majority vote is.
So that means that if you were in a state which was, mostly Republican, say 60%
right.
of the votes went to Republican, but the popular vote winner was a Democrat, that all your Electoral College votes would go to the Democrat.
Republican Iowa, they would just say, both parties would agree, they've both been victimized, but it's really the Democrats that are being victimized by the most, for the most. But yeah, theoretically, Iowa would then, right, under that rule, Republican Iowa would still have to send its 6 electorals. They would just—it's a way around the Electoral College without a constitutional amendment.
Right.
And
that makes
a certain amount of sense. I mean, now, by the way, there are also issues in this election we are finding out about the actual popular vote, and in the contested states that Trump won.
What do you mean?
Which we can talk about later. But there are disturbing disparities between what the exit poll said and what the final vote totals were in Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, right, all that.
I'd like to talk about that. I want to give you two more quotes.
That's like the other issue,
Right. Two more quotes, this time from Donald Trump. This one's 2012. He tweeted in the last election, "The phony Electoral College made a laughingstock out of our nation. The loser won." And the reason he tweeted that was because he thought Romney had won the popular vote and Obama
sure.
won the Electoral College, but it turned out that Obama had won both, so he deleted the tweet. But some people preserved it. But today,
right.
Donald Trump tweeted, "The Electoral College is actually genius in that it brings all states, including the smaller ones, into play. Campaigning is much different."
Well, see, here's the thing about Trump, and, let's go, it's just to even quote them is to note the hypocrisy. It's absurd, right? It's just the situational morality, the situational ethics. I'm against something when it doesn't work the way I want it to, and I'm for something when it works for me. But, I mean, this is one of the problems with understanding what we're up against with Trump. Trump consistently just says whatever he thinks serve his interests. I don't think we really know if he's as much as a racist and a sexist. And, well, the sexist is pretty clear. How much he's really going to be a nativist and how much he's really going to be a vicious racist. I mean, I'm not going to give him any slack at all. But there's something that's been going around, which is an interview with him from years ago, and I'm still trying to nail it down exactly what it is, where he's quoted saying, I just say anything to get these angry yahoos out in the countryside to vote for me. I mean, he says it in a very manipulative way. And it's almost like the suggestion that he's less that way than he's pretending to be, just to rally, this right-wing base behind him. I mean, this is sort of uncharted territory in the extent to which we've had a candidate who just says anything.
I kind of think that every statement from Donald Trump is completely without the context of anything he said before. It's just whatever
we've
the
We've always
current...
had a little bit of that. I mean, manipulation is sort of the essence of politicians, but this is on a scale that's just mind-boggling.
Right. Now, yeah. And then quote from Newt Gingrich, he talked about the winner-take-all method. So how many states still use a winner-take-all method? And can you first explain what that is for people who might not understand how that differs?
Well,
from...
I think it's the majority of them. I'm not enough of an expert. I heard them when they were talking about the map on the night referring to, was it Maine? And something in Oklahoma, or was it Nebraska? And maybe some of your listeners know that answer to that question. So there were some somewhat proportional allocation of electoral votes in just a couple of marginal jurisdictions, but for the great majority, the preponderant majority of the states, then who wins the popular vote in that state gets all of the electoral college votes in that state. So, I mean, if Barack Obama beats Mitt Romney, 50.8% to 49.2%. Well, that's too bad for Mitt Romney. He ain't getting 49% of the electors. He's getting them all. So whatever the total electoral college vote for Pennsylvania is, in that example, and Pennsylvania is a big, big state, he gets them all. So, I mean, that's winner take all.
Right, right. I mean, that seems, even if you like the electoral college, it's hard to find a justification for that system so that all the Republicans...
First past the post, winner take all, right? What it, one thing that does is complicate things entirely. I mean, it's not only just sort of horrific for the losers, right? I mean, you could go as high as 49% and you got nothing. But it intimidates parties outside the two dominant parties because they may not like Hillary Clinton very much, like all the Greens I know and many of the Bernie... Right. Sanders supporters, I know, but by God, they're not about to cast a ballot for their third party because they won't get anything for getting 20% of the vote. I mean, that's how a party starts. You're not going to win it all the first time.
Right.
You have to build. You want to be able to get 5%, maybe 10% the next time, and then build. That happens in European countries with proportional representation, where you know that a certain percentage of the vote means a certain percent of the representatives. But here, you're just completely discouraged about doing that. And,
well, presidentially...
After polling data forever has shown Americans don't think that just two parties adequately represents the spectrum of opinion in this country, and it truly doesn't.
Yeah, I think the election process is a process of herding people towards making a decision on two candidates in the booth and ignoring any other candidates, ignoring the Libertarian, ignoring the Green, because it's emphasized so many times that you're wasting your vote. And I've also seen several tweets following the election of shaming those who voted Green, the Democrats trying to shame those who voted Green, saying, you did this. It's your responsibility.
Well, that's not going to work much this time because Jill Stein barely got past 1%.
I still see it, even though it's even though there's really no justification for that criticism. What about something like a transferable vote where you can say, I want to vote Green, Democrat, Libertarian, Republican, or Republican, Libertarian, Green, Democrat, something like that? And if your first candidate...
Oh, well, you could merge. That is a way... That there's something to be said for that. That is a way to... How shall I put it? You're still scared. You're still scared of the worst evil. If you're a Green, you might think that was Trump. Of course, you might not, too. I mean, we can talk about that, too. There's a lot of people on the left that are not necessarily all that upset that the corporate neoliberal centrist Democrats have had their head handed to them this time. But let's say you're a Green who thinks that Trump might be a fascist and, that he really is as bad as some people say. And you don't want to do anything that might allow him to get in there, but you still would like to be able to maintain some sort of party identity. You would still be able to like in the end of the day for the results to show that the Green Party got a certain number of votes, right? You know, that you may have voted for Hillary Clinton to block Trump, but you still are this party. And there's something to be said for that. There'd be some Another thing, election reformers. I don't know if that's what you meant by transferable.
Yeah,
but it might
that's
be
basically
right. Yeah,
if
well,
you're a progressive,
right, so you can vote for the viable major party candidate with and still maintain a party identification and a vote for
right.
the party that you're with. Yes,
right.
There is some talk. Reformers, election reformers, have talked forever about instant runoff, so that you could do your third or your fourth party voting with the understanding that the final results come in a follow-up election in which the top two vote-getters have a face-off, right? So you don't have to be too scared to vote for your party and for your candidate because you
I
know there's
instant,
still... There, yeah.
With instant runoff, it's called instant runoff because you actually
yeah.
vote for all your choices at one point. And so
well,
if you
right.
let's
yeah.
say that you vote green, they then basically
right.
say, okay, Jill
yeah.
Stein only got 2%
right.
or 3%. So we throw those votes
sure.
away, but we transfer them to your second
right.
choice.
So you're
and
not asking
we draw the libertarian.
For people to trudge back to the polls again in a week, right, yeah.
Right. And,
yeah.
I mean, I think the advantage to me of that kind of a system is that you're sending a signal. If the green vote grows to, say, 10%, well, the Democrats are going to have to up their environmental game or other green policies
right.
in order to capture those people back. Otherwise, they could face a point where the green vote exceeds the Democrat vote, and they certainly don't want that to happen.
Right, yeah. Now, I mean, ultimately, I think we need some form of proportional representation, and we need private money completely taken out of public elections and media reform as well, too. I mean, one of the ways that the third parties are absurdly excluded is through the debate process. You know,
well,
imagine if this wily guy like Ralph Nader could actually get in front of television with these sort of dismal corporate candidates, and you know that might give him something of a chance.
Right. Although, actually, I don't think it's the media that's responsible. It's the Presidential Debate Commission is owned by the Republican and Democratic
sure.
parties.
Right.
I should confess, I'm actually Canadian, so I'm just interested in this because. In some sense, America is the government of the world. But, I mean, in
oh,
Canada,
yeah.
we actually have the media that runs the debates, like the major
right.
CBC, CTV. They all get together and run the debates. And there have been also big fights in Canada over should the Green Party get into the debates. And more recently, the answer has been yes, but it took well over a decade for that to happen.
Well, our media is very compromised, too, because it's kind of a monopoly of five or six oligopolies, which are for-profit
mm-hmm.
outfits. And really, PBS here is kind of a farce and wholly dependent on corporate donation and so forth. That, you know, that you can't, right. I mean, you'd want, when you say the media should do it, then you would want that with a genuinely public media, disinterested.
I'm not saying that the media should do it. I'm just saying that our experience in Canada with the media running the debate show
sure.
is not that much better than in the United States.
Right.
Although I think it's somewhat more fair. They have somewhat less bias, and you know, in the end, I think the media benefits from a more exciting debate.
Well, you clearly have a better process that in the past allowed the new Democratic Party to get in and bring about something like single-payer health insurance, which, by the way, most Americans in polling data have supported for as long as I paid attention to polling data. It's like their top choice.
Well, actually,
you know?
The NDP never really got in, but they were carving so many votes from the major parties that the major parties started to steal their platforms.
Right.
So
right,
basically
right.
Canada got single-payer health care because the Liberals were concerned that the NDP were going to become the government,
mm-hmm.
so they better steal
right.
some of their policies.
Well, Sunder on the left, you know, is part of how reform takes place. We've had different versions of that in the United States, but we've never really empowered third, fourth parties to the point that they could quite do it that way down here.
Yeah, it seems like they're just about completely suppressed.
You know, and getting to where we can do that probably means a constitutional overhaul of some kind. I mean, we are just absurdly attached to our charter document that sets the rules of the game for how we do politics,
mm-hmm.
how we set up our well, how we set up our party system sort of flows out of it all. And it's very distinctive and unique among modern nations. It's amazing how frequently, I mean, sometimes to the point it's dysfunctional, but how frequently other countries sort of tear up their charters and sort of start over again and write them in accord with new modern principles updated to the reality of society right now. I understand that Bolivia has a constitution that actually includes language acknowledging the rights and sovereignty of livable ecology. I mean, imagine that, something like that.
Right. Canada right now is investigating alternatives to the first past the post system, such as proportional representation. And there were a lot of people said that we'd have to change the constitution in Canada, but eventually they decided that Parliament, you know, equivalent to Congress, can just change the way the elections are run. But one of the big differences in Canada is that Canada actually has federal elections, and I think one of the bizarre things in the U.S. is that the states basically control the majority of the aspects of federal elections.
Right. Well, as I say, the revising the Constitution is incredibly difficult down here. There is some legal literature about some interesting things that states have done at the state level to rewrite their state constitutions, not going through a cumbersome, incredibly cumbersome process like Article 5 in the U.S. Constitution, but by through popular referendums. And I'm wondering if we're ever going to hear serious calls for a nationwide referendum for a and to hold constitutional conventions around the country. I mean, I would... I don't think there's anything mysterious about what a lot of the contents of a democracy amendment would be in this country. I think it's the kind of thing we don't have to follow in the wake of a mass popular anti-authoritarian, anti-corporate uprising. But it would certainly include proportional representation, full public financing of elections. I could go on. I mean, for example, we don't even make Election Day a national holiday here, like many countries
right.
do. I mean, it should be a day off. We should celebrate, if we were a democracy, we should celebrate citizen engagement. I mean, we take off for Thanksgiving, July 4th, and all kinds of things. So, you know, there would be a political democracy amendment. I think there might also be either in an included or separate economic democracy amendment based on the theory that, as the former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis once said, that we have to choose. We can have wealth concentrated in the hands of very few, or we can have democracy. But we cannot have both. And, you know, Bernie Sanders was absolutely right as he campaigned in the primaries when he pointed out that this is just an astonishing statistic. 0.1% of the population has about as much wealth as the bottom 90% of the population, besides being economically and environmentally dysfunctional. That kind of concentration of wealth makes anything remotely like popular sovereignty, like democracy, like democratic self-rule, you know, fairly impossible.
Well, actually, one of the things, I want to make two comments about that. Well, one of the things you said at first was when America started, it was the elites, the 1% at that time, which was white property-owning men, who ran the country. And because of the influence of money and that court case, I can't remember the name, which basically overturned limits on campaign funding, we basically have the 1% who have money, they're not all white men, but probably the majority, basically controlling the elections because they're pouring millions of dollars, billions of dollars into the election.
Well, the two key Supreme Court decisions were 2010 Citizens United, which sort of just unlimited, which allowed corporations to go into their business treasuries and basically just contribute with no limits at all, and to so-called independent expenditures, not directly supervised by the campaigns, but basically aligned with the campaigns of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a horrible decision in 1975 called Buckley v. Valeo, which essentially defined money as free speech. It equated money as free speech. It said that restrictions on contributions were restrictions on free speech. And then it's a more complicated decision than that. And, you know, and there is what election reformers down here have referred to as the wealth primary. We all remember down in this country the white primary that was prevalent all across the South, which essentially barred African-Americans from being in the either primary elections or the general election just by virtue of their skin color. But you can technically enfranchise everybody regardless of their race, color, creed, sexual orientation, national origin, or whatever. And it can become sort of irrelevant if a candidate has no chance of being viable without either being personally wealthy himself or being intimately connected to and backed by people who are personally wealthy, you know, and with the strings attached, meaning that you owe your position to their power and their influence. And, you know, free speech is an interesting concept. We all sort of have it down here in the United States, but really, what is my free speech? My ability to speak on the street corner compared to that of a billionaire's. I mean, just think of it in terms of the volume of your megaphone, you know, and how
right.
Their free speech drowns out my free speech. My free speech sort of becomes like the mumblings of someone sitting in a movie theater in the front row, and you can sort of barely hear me while the screen is just, you know, blaring at high volume. It doesn't really mean all that much.
Well, interestingly, with all of these, the demonstrations, anti-Trump demonstrations that occurred afterwards. And I was going to say spontaneous, but the immediate response from Trump supporters was, these are all paid demonstrators. But I was thinking, I haven't seen any evidence that that's the case, although some of them may be election organizers who were paid as part of the election. But
well, you know, sure. Go ahead.
I think that most of them are probably people who were upset because of some of the things Donald Trump has said, that Mexicans are rapists, that we need to throw all the Muslims out, we need to build a wall with Mexico, all of those things. But
that's
that seems to be free speech. But the people who like Trump are saying, well, that's the wrong kind of free speech, and we need to send the police out in the streets and crack a few heads and get these people to go home.
Well, you know, I don't doubt that some parts of the sort of liberal NGO network and the paid activists that work for them, you know, have played roles, you know, in some of the demonstrations. That wouldn't stop me from participating in them, however. And, you know, the ones that I participated in Iowa City, and I'll probably go to another one at 5 o'clock today, I mean, that started because a bunch of kids in high school, you know, in this liberal campus town, gay kids, black kids, a lot of female students, high school and college students,
right,
sort of showed up down on the campus. They weren't bussed there by MoveOn.org. They don't have money from George Soros or some other nefarious, you know, global financer. They just are horrified at the racism and the sexism and the xenophobia of Donald Trump. They really are genuinely horrified by it. Some of them, there was a little more shedding of tears for Hillary Clinton that I'm comfortable with, because I have a concept of her as being actually quite culpable in the election of Trump and being a very conservative de facto Republican in a way herself. But there's limits to that too, and there were some lefties and some radical types and just some vaguely progressives, a lot of Bernie types, and they just kept marching north. Had great conversations along the way. They're organizing. They just kept going, and a couple of radicals up front of the march said, let's go all the way to the interstate, and they went 3 miles north and blocked the interstate highway and got some news that way, and it was a very dramatic moment. And just when it was about to get too hairy, you're bottling up traffic too much, they quite intelligently said, okay, we've made our point, and they went back.
Right.
MoveOn didn't do that. George Soros didn't do that. They did that on their own.
But what's the irony, I think, is that let's say that they were all paid $16 an hour by George Soros, which I've heard said.
Yeah.
I don't believe it, but I've heard it. But let's say if money is free speech, then that's George Soros's free speech. So why would it be a problem? Why would it be true, too.
Yeah, more hypocrisy, right?
Why would it devalue this statement? It's just George Soros using his microphone of paying a bunch of college kids $16 an hour. And I just want to say, I don't believe that. I've seen no evidence of that. But like you say, there's probably some of those people are working for NGOs that
George Soros wants to write me a protest for write me a check for protesting and building the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline here in Iowa. I would inform him in no uncertain terms there's absolutely no strings attached whatsoever. And that if he thinks I'm going to use this stuff in order to get dismal neoliberal dollar Democrats back in office, he can forget it. And he'd probably withdraw the check. But I'm not gonna not show up against a protest against a possibly fascist president who did not have even the decency. For the second time in my life, a president didn't have the decency to win the popular vote. And again, to mention something I mentioned before, who appears to have won through literal voting software, voting machine, and voter suppression rigging of the election in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and North Carolina. I'm not going to not protest that because I'm not a Clinton Democrat. I'm not. But I do support the integrity of elections and all of that.
Well, let's talk about voting machines because... one of the differences between, say, Canada and the United States is in Canada, elections are completely paper, but Canadian elections are a lot simpler because we're generally just going to vote for one person, and I know in the United States you may be voting for 10 or 20 people plus initiatives and other things like that, so it would be complicated with paper. But you also have some machines that have no paper trail or no way to know whether your vote was actually recorded or not. So what
is madness? It's absolute madness. I mean, the official voting machine outcome violated the exit polls at a level down here that just defies basic statistics. It's as if Trump went to the casino and pulled up the biggest prize on the slot machine 25 times in a row. I mean, the U.S. State Department would call an election with such, impossible disparities, totally invalid. Well, it would if such an election in another country put in a candidate that Washington didn't like. I mean, right-wing private companies tied to the neocon establishment are preposterously enough in charge of proprietary vote tabulating software, voting machines. This is software machines that have actually been used by some of these same companies, and don't ask me to name all of them, that have actually subverted elections in the third world in the past. And you combine that with voter suppression, particularly the black and Latino vote in districts all the way down to the precinct level, then this is how you ensure a Republican victory. It happened in 2000. It happened in 2004 with John Kerry, who may very well have actually won Ohio. And every indication, I'm sure, is going to be that happened in 2016. Trump went on and on and on about how it was rigged, that the system was rigged, and he was right. What he didn't say is it would be rigged on his behalf because these companies tilt right, and they always have.
Right. Now, speaking of...
There's a wonderful interview on Counterpunch Radio with Bob Fitrakis about this. And Bob is the political scientist and attorney who is the leading expert on voter integrity. Sorry.
Who's the guy who's done a lot of stuff on voter suppression? Jeremy Scahill?
Palast, Greg Palast.
Greg Palast, sorry, I get those two guys mixed up for some reason. So Greg Palast said that some of these voting machines have a mechanism to, produce a paper receipt or something like that, and it was turned
out... they're all different. They're different by state, even at the down-of-the-county precinct level, but I've heard that, yeah.
Yes. Now, regarding voter suppression, in Oregon, I heard in this election, they have automatic voter registration, and I don't know if that is when you get a driver's license or something like that. And they had 76% turnout, which is much higher than the state.
Yeah. Rumors are spread that people with felony records, and it's a lot of the black population because of our criminal justice system, aren't allowed to vote, even in states where they are allowed to vote. I can't tell you how many times I've heard black voters say, I can't vote because I have a felony record. Well, which is actually true in parts of the South, and oddly enough, right. in Iowa. But it's not true in most of the North. It just isn't. But they don't bother. People are been led to believe that they're going to have photo IDs when they don't have photo IDs. And, I mean, there are broken machines in low-income voting districts. There are overly long lines, and people just give up, and they go home. There is confusion about where they're supposed to vote, and just all kinds of things like that. Yeah.
Right, and I can imagine that somebody who's working three jobs to make ends meet, if they're not able to do advanced voting or not able to do voting by mail, may just
right.
not want to take the time. If they think it might be 3 or 4 hours, that's a lot of time when they could be earning $8 an hour at a minimum wage
well,
job.
They're more likely to take time when they think the candidate is really inspiring and exciting and I don't know, there's such a charisma deficit between Barack Obama, who, by the way, was actually a person of color, and, you know, and Hillary Clinton.
Yes,
who,
and actually one of the arguments against people voting for Donald Trump all being racist is that many of them voted for Obama the last time around.
Yeah. People voted for Trump are more complicated than being just called racists, unfortunately, or sexist, misogynist, or whatever.
Right.
There is racism and sexism that's all too rife in the white working and middle classes, but many people who aren't really... Well, racism is a complicated thing. People who aren't bigoted in their personal behavior and conduct
right.
Can still kind of be racist because they refuse to understand institutional societal racism, you know, how the labor market works and all of that. But yeah, people who aren't racist who just were haven't gotten anything, really, out of the age of Barack Obama. I mean, we've just, the upward distribution of wealth and the economic precariousness, all of these things. I mean, I could mention global warming. I think every year under Trump has been the hottest year under Obama has been the hottest year on record. Deportations were through the roof under Barack Obama. He just did
right.
it in a less military, you know, more quiet, subtle, sophisticated, and less open military way.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was going to say, when it comes to money, I think one of the problems with Hillary's campaign is that she seemed obsessed with raising money. And if you were going to drop a large check on Hillary Clinton, you could have her over
right.
for supper. But if you were just an ordinary voter, then there really weren't any rallies, and it just didn't seem exciting.
I think the Clintons took in these huge speaking fees from people like Goldman Sachs and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange way in excess of what they actually needed to do. You know, it's as if they were just thumbing their nose at working class people. People did not like to hear that you've given four speeches for $250,000 a pop to a leading financial firm that's one of the firms that, you know, collapsed the economy. You know, Citibank, when Obama came in, Bob Rubin, one of his leading financiers, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, who then moved to Citibank after he engineered some financial derivative changes that benefited Citibank a great deal. Bob Rubin, who's also the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, and his colleagues at Citibank, pretty much picked half of Barack Obama's opening cabinet, right? The Hope and
right.
Change cabinet of 2008. People know this kind of thing. They sense it. They pick it up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and now, so Trump gets to pose as a populist, and now we know his transition team is full of billionaires and millionaires. So, you know.
Well, I mean, he was seducing the voters. He was telling you what you wanted to hear, and everybody
yeah.
kind of knew that Hillary was, like, reluctantly saying that she was in favor of increasing the minimum wage, and she was reluctantly saying she was against the TPP.
Yeah.
But everybody knew that she was lying,
right.
and that the first
well,
opportunity to back down, she would have backed down. Whereas Trump,
Bernie made her do it, and if Bernie had made her do it, then probably Elizabeth Warren would have made her do it. Even if those two hadn't come in, just the threat of a kind of pitchfork rebellion and reluctance. You know, Christopher Hitchens, who I was never all that big a fan of, but he once had this wonderful phrase in his book about the Clintons. He said the essence of American politics is the manipulation of populism by elitism. The Democrats do that manipulation just sort of in a more kind of, you know, politically correct, culturally sensitive kind of way, and the Republicans do the same thing in a kind of nastier. I call it Americaner, based on the Afrikaners, you know, the of South Africa,
right.
K-I-N-N-E-R, sort of white nationalist Americaner kind of way. But either way. Though Trump is going to be different, I'm really fascinated to see what his team of strategy makers looks like. But over the different quadrennial administrations, the core team around who the president is, it looks remarkably identical. It really does. It tends to be made up of people from transnational capital and high finance and the leading think tanks of the country, with the granddaddy of them all, the Council on Foreign Relations, in the lead. That may be there may be a difference, more of a difference than we see with Trump.
Yeah.
In that regard,
the way I summarize it as an outsider is that the Republicans say that they're going to do all these horrible things, and like build a wall, kick out all the Muslims, and you know that when they get in, they're not going to do all of those things. They might do some horrible things, but not everything they said. And the Democrats say they're going to do all these wonderful things, and you know that when they get in, they're not. They're both lying to you
in different ways.
And
Trump could end up doing some of the horrible things that he said he wouldn't do, like end up in a military conflict with Russia. I think there's a kind of stand down for now.
Right.
And Hillary, one sigh of relief that many of us on the left have is that Hillary had some very dangerous talk about no-fly zones over Syria and even seeing that the military option wasn't off the table with dealing Russia. I mean, that's just madness. But if Trump gets in and, hands over policy to Pence, which seems entirely possible at a certain level, and Pence has said his role model as vice president was Dick Cheney. Well, that doesn't sound very isolationist. That sounds rather expansionist and aggressive. So
it's hard to say.
You know,
I mean, I saw an interesting thing.
It's hard to say. Yeah.
Right. An interesting thing is Trump's relationship with Putin, I'm not so sure that Putin really had his hands in as deep as the Democrats like to think. But clearly, Putin seemed to want Trump to win, and Trump seems to like Putin. But the big conflict, of course, is Russia against the Ukraine. And if there's such a thing as the alt-right is highly involved in the Ukrainian government. So now you've got Russia, a friend of Trump, nose-to-nose with the alt-right in the Ukraine. And that just seems like an ideological conflict for Trump.
Right. Yeah, Steve Bannon, he's going to be Trump's...
number two.
I don't know. Well, is there? Oh, my God. I mean, this guy is a, for your listeners, Steve Bannon is a darn near fascist, alt-right, at the very least, a vicious white nationalist, sort of paranoid style, head of a right-wing website.
Breitbart.
That is a hideous. Right, Breitbart. And you say he's his number two. So he's his top advisor, a cabinet member for Trump. I don't, down here in the United States, I'd be curious to know what percentage of the electorate could actually identify. I used to teach history, you know, so I'd like to put that in as a name. You know, one part of a history exam was always usually five or so IDs, you know, Frederick Douglass, Grover Cleveland, see if kids could say who they were. I'd like to know what percentage of the population could even identify Steve Bannon and Breitbart and what they say and what they do. That's the scariest thing yet. Is Bannon's role. He's a very dangerous man. Yeah,
one of the dangerous. One of the very scary things, I think, is this new idea of fake news, of actually generating stories. I'm pretty skeptical when I read the news, and I have an interest in global affairs and things, so I don't always fall for these things. Like when somebody said, you know, liberals in Pennsylvania had beaten some veteran to death, I immediately looked it up, and it turned out to be a video from 2 years ago that they'd recycled to try to make it look like these anti-Trump demonstrators were out killing patriots. But there was a story about an FBI agent who killed his wife, committed suicide, burned his house down, and the story was that this might be Hillary Clinton getting revenge on the FBI for what they did to her. But it turned out to be a completely fake story, I learned later, but I got into it far enough to accept the fact that this was an FBI agent working on the Hillary Clinton affair who died in this murder-suicide that might actually be a murder-murder.
And social media allows these things to show up in the margins if you look on your Facebook page, and you'll get a link to this thing, and then it might take you to something else. I've seen them with politics. I've seen them with sports. I remember during the basketball playoffs last year, there was just this absurd link that went all around, and it was entirely believable at first that one player on one team had attacked Steph Curry. That's who it was. They had attacked Steph Curry and his small daughter. And people are just like, did you see what he said about Steph Curry and his daughter? Really? It's just made up.
I mean, I think the problem with those things is the people who generate them know that even after they're debunked, they will still continue to circulate, and people will still continue to believe them.
Well, repeat something enough over and over again is enough.
Here's another one.
I've noticed that with calling Obama. You know, you talk about a fake thing. I mean, I'm actually a socialist. I've been a socialist since I was 19 years old, democratic socialist. And just a repetition of the notion that neoliberal corporatists like Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton are socialists. It's just said so pervasively in a certain part of the media, in a right-wing noise machine, over and over again, and it just gets believed.
I mean, I don't really have a problem. I mean, socialism is this wide spectrum that goes from Stalin on the one end to, like, the British government on the other end, where you have public schools and you have public-funded health care and a few things like that. That's also socialism.
But to call Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton a socialist is absurd.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have single-payer health care, for example, so that's, like, the primary socialist program is health care.
Well, thanks in part to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, both of whom in the first year of the Clinton presidency and then in the first year of the Obama presidency choreographed the healthcare debate in such a way as to militantly exclude single payer, or even a limited public option, both of which were supported by irrelevantly by the majority of the population in the United States of America. I mean, I think sometimes people in other parts of the world, I don't know if it's true in Canada, have a hard time wrapping their minds around how authoritarian, in essence, U.S. politics and policy really are.
Well, yeah, I remember the debates over healthcare where people who wanted to push single-payer healthcare were excluded with the enthusiastic participation of the president, right, to make sure that
including the legendary, long-standing Detroit-area congressman right across the lake from Canada, John Conyers from Detroit, who was a legendary black civil rights politician, who I'm sure Obama knew on a personal level, excluded initially from any input in the task force that was talking about that, including even Obama's personal physician, Dr. Quentin Young, a white, a very liberal Hyde Park, Chicago doctor who couldn't get in the door to discuss. So, you know, there's no limits to the betrayals. Once these people get in office, you can ask Jeremiah. Reference Jeremiah Wright about that.
Right. Well, yeah, I've lost track of what I was going to say. Anyway, we're coming towards the end of our time together. So is there something more that you would like to add to this discussion?
Well, I think there's some silver linings to what's happened. I find people engaged about we need to do something on a grassroots level, you know, here in this country, in language that I haven't heard in a long time. I see an upsurge of activism, some people thinking deeply, sort of structurally, about how the government is set up, how the political process is set up. You know, that's a real silver lining. Another silver lining is that the dismal dollar neoliberal ideology atop the Democratic Party, the Bob Rubin-Obama-Clinton tendency, the neoliberal tendency, has really taken a blow here. I don't know if this opens up things for a third party. Third parties are very difficult in this country. Or it opens up room for younger, more progressive people, a lot of the Bernie Sandernista types, to come in and take over the Democratic Party. Or it just opens up the door for a kind of movement, social movement and protest politics, you know, beneath and beyond these major party candidate center extravaganzas that down here just get sold to us as the only politics that matter. It's like this very limited definition of citizenship down here says that you go into a voting booth and mark a ballot once every 4 years, and they're supposed to go home and let other people run the world. Well, you know, that feels very dead right now. That is not where kids are. They have a different, they're going to develop a different set of politics. They need to not get sucked back into the old authoritarian politics as they form their movements.
Well, that's a hopeful note to end on, and with the music, we are coming to an end. So thank you so much for joining me today.
I enjoyed it. Let's talk again in the future.
I will send you a link to the show afterwards. Goodbye.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay, goodbye. Bye-bye.